This is Fresh Air. It wasn't that long ago that tennis players wore white, played the game with wooden rackets, while fans watched quietly and applauded politely. Tennis is more boisterous now and more popular. A top tennis player can earn anywhere from a couple of $1 million to $10 million a year from tournaments and corporate endorsements. And you're as likely to read about Jimmy Connors, Martina Navratilova, or Jennifer Capriati in a gossip column as on the sports page. John Feinstein is a sports writer and will be covering this year's U.S. Open for World Tennis Magazine. He traveled with the players in the 1990-91 pro tennis circuit and has written a book about on-the-court play and behind-the-scenes deals. It's called Hard Courts. I spoke with Feinstein about the sport and about John McEnroe, whom Feinstein says exemplifies what is best and worst in tennis.
I think that McEnroe is one of the most honest people I've ever met in sports. Whether you like him or not, what you see is what you get with John. There's no phoniness there, unlike with someone like Andre Agassi, who will say whatever someone puts in his mouth at a given time. John says what he thinks at all times. Clearly, his talent is as great as anyone who's ever played the game, and yet he's never grown up. He's never come to understand, you know, the old theory about two-year-olds who, as they grow older, they realize that they are not the center of the universe. John has had trouble dealing with that notion. I think he's gotten better now that he has his own children. But like many tennis players, he really thinks that he is the center of the universe. And if somebody does something wrong, it's directed right at him. I once was talking to him about umpires, and I said, you know, they make mistakes, but you know they're not out to get you. And he said, oh, no, they are out to get me. They make mistakes, but make no mistake about it. They are out to get me. And he really believes that.
He is a remarkable player and plays with such intensity and finesse, but he doesn't look like he's having fun. He looks like a kind of joyless player.
Well, I think you can say that of most of the players of this generation, to be fair to John. I mean, Yvonne Lendl isn't exactly a bunch of laughs out there. And in the last couple of years, neither has Boris Becker been. I think Boris was when he first came on tour, when he won Wimbledon at age 17. But I don't see a whole lot of chuckles out there among the players these days. But you're right in that I don't think John has gotten a great deal of joy out of his greatness. And that's too bad. And I think now, only now, in his 30s, he's 32 now, is he realizing what he had? Mary Carrillo, the commentator who grew up with John in Douglaston, made a great point, I think. She said that it's a shame because he didn't appreciate his genius until it was gone.
In the old days, professional tennis players would get money when they won, and that was how they made their money. How does money work now in tennis?
Well, to be fair, there have always been under-the-table payments in tennis, going back to the Australians in the 1960s when they were supposed to be, quote, amateurs, unquote, and they would get appearance fees for going to certain tournaments, but you were talking $200, $400, something like that. Now the way it works is that most top players will not step on a court in a non-Grand Slam tournament, the Grand Slams being the Australian, French, and U.S. Opens and Wimbledon. And almost any other tournament before a McEnroe, a Lendl, an Agassi, a Becker will play, they will get a guarantee up front. In other words, you show up to play, you're going to get X dollars no matter what round you lose in. The guarantees can go as high as $300,000 for a single week. Many of the players who go to Japan, it's such a long trip, demand that kind of money. Yvonne Lendl has a standing rule that for every 10 hours he has to fly to play in a tournament, his appearance fee goes up by $50,000. So that when you read in the paper that Yvonne Lendl won $70,000 for winning the tournament this week, well, that's really not true. He got $150,000 or $200,000 just to show up, regardless of whether he won the tournament. And it's really a sham that's being carried out on the fans.
When did players begin to wear product and corporate logos all over their shirts?
It's something that's evolved over the last 15 years. Somebody first had the idea that if you put a logo in the right place when a match was on television, that the TV cameras would be forced to show it. Obviously, you see a tennis player's arms all the time, so that was a logical place to start putting patches. As a result of patches proliferating, the people who run the game, both the International Tennis Federation and the Men's Tennis Council and later the ATP, made rules on how big the patch could be and where it could go and how many you could wear. But players still look like mini billboards when they walk out there if they're big enough stars that corporations are willing to pay for their arms.
Well, do companies pay X number of dollars for an arm versus a shoulder versus the back?
Well, it depends, again, on what the deal involves. A deal, for example, Jennifer Capriati last year had a two-tournament deal with Texaco at the French Open in Wimbledon just to wear a patch, okay? And she was paid $100,000 just to wear the patch for two tournaments. She then made a different deal with Oil of Olay, which involved television commercials and endorsing the product and wearing the patch, that was a multi-million dollar deal over a period of 5 years. Now, Jennifer Capriati was 14 when she made the deal. I don't think her mother was old enough to use Oil of Olay at that point, and yet she was endorsing the product.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Feinstein. He's a sports writer, has written a number of books about a variety of different sports. His latest one is about tennis. It's called Hard Courts, Real Life on the Professional Tennis Tours. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Sports writer John Feinstein is my guest. It seems to me that in women's tennis, that women's tennis players get more coverage than most female athletes of other sports. Would you agree with that?
I think so. I think that women tennis players have come as close to being considered equals with their male counterparts as in any sport, because of people like Chris Evert, because of the Billie Jean King-Bobby Riggs match and the attention that women's tennis got there, because of all the money that Philip Morris and Virginia, and through its subsidiary Virginia Slims, put into women's tennis in the 1970s, and because of the Evert-Navratilova rivalry, women's tennis has received far more attention than almost any other women's sport.
Do women players talk about the kind of pressure on them to not only play well but look good on the court?
Some of them have. Carling Bassett, who was John Bassett, the millionaire sports investor daughter, talked very honestly about it. She was a bulimic and an anorexic, one of several in women's tennis over the last few years, and she has talked very openly about fighting the disease and about the pressure to look good and about the pressure to be thin. And she thinks that to some degree, everybody models their daughter after Chris Evert, because Chris Evert was always the pretty girl next door, quote-unquote. Zena Garrison went through the same thing. She said to me, you know, we go out there in short skirts to play all the time. Well, if you're overweight, your legs aren't going to look very good. And so there's tremendous pressure on you in terms of being marketed, and these women are marketed to look thin and look good.
Do you think Martina Navratilova's revelation, the fact that she's a lesbian, has that hurt her at all as a player?
No, not as a player. I think that sometimes it has hurt her as a person, because she's very sensitive, and when the crowd is against her, the crowd was almost always against her when she played Evert. The crowd has always been against her when she plays the younger players as they're coming up. That hurts her. She can't understand why someone who has been as great a player as she is, has always been a gracious winner, always been a gracious loser, has not gained more appreciation. She's gained some. I think people have come to respect her over the years, but it's been very grudging, and I think that hurts her. It's hurt her in endorsements. She doesn't make nearly as much money in endorsements as a player of her caliber would make if not for that revelation, and she is the first one to admit it. But I don't think it's ever hurt her as a player.
You're saying that the crowd is against her because she's a lesbian?
No, I can't say that. I can't go and talk to 19,000 people. But over the years, historically, she has never been the crowd favorite. Now, is that because she's a Czech-turned American? Is that because she plays such an aggressive game? Is that because she's gay? I don't know. But I do know that over the years, she has never been the crowd favorite, and that she's very sensitive to that fact.
I'm speaking with sports writer John Feinstein, and we're talking about professional tennis. You say that Andre Agassi is rather disliked by other players on the tennis circuit. Why?
Because he's not real. I think that, for example, McEnroe, who may upset people with things that he says at times, they know he means it. They know that whatever John says, it comes from the heart. Agassi will say whatever will sell products. Whatever his agent, whatever his coach, whatever his brother, who is omnipresent in his life, tell him is the best thing to say at that particular moment. And I think players resent that. They think he's fake. Tennis players, athletes in general, don't like people who are fakes.
I've watched him play, and I must say, with his fancy clothes and his long hair, that when he's winning, he looks great. But when he's losing, somehow those clothes and that great haircut makes him look silly.
They start to look silly, don't they? And at the biggest moments is when he tends to play his worst tennis. He's been in 3 Grand Slam finals and hasn't won any of them. Of course, Ivan Lendl lost his first 4 Grand Slam finals and went on to become a champion. And Agassi may yet do that. He may outgrow this phase and realize that it's more important how you play and not what you wear. His shirts are tailored literally so that they're shorter in the front so that whenever he hits a forehand, they come up and people can see his stomach muscles.
Really?
Oh, yes. He insisted that he insisted that the shirts be designed that way.
Well, I'm in shock. I'm trying to recover myself. What makes Wimbledon the premier tournament still? After all these years?
Well, there are a number of things. The tradition obviously has a great deal to do with it. Wimbledon is unique because it's played on grass. None of the other major tournaments are played on grass anymore, whereas in the past, 3 of them were. Now only Wimbledon is. It's played in a small private club. The stadium itself is much smaller and much more intimate than any of the stadiums where the other Grand Slams are held. The presence of royalty in the box every day gives it Wimbledon an aura that none of the other tournaments have. Wimbledon is the only tournament that does not sell off every inch of space to corporations to put their signs up. So there is a throwback feeling when you're at center court at Wimbledon that this is how tennis used to be when they didn't play for big money, when they weren't all wearing corporate logos all over their arms. The club still insisted players wear white. Even Agassi wore white this year when he finally just deigned to come back to Wimbledon. So Wimbledon is like in another era of tennis. It's almost a complete throwback, and I think people like that. It's a nice change from the other 50 weeks of the year when everybody's chasing every buck they can find.
Do you think it'll stay that way?
I do. I really do. Wimbledon makes a lot of money. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's not like they're not in the 20th century. They make a lot of money off of television. They market their clothes and their equipment very well. And there's no reason to believe that they're going to have to change.
Wimbledon allowed cheering this year. Isn't that right?
Well, Wimbledon never didn't allow cheering. It's just that it's so difficult to get a ticket to Wimbledon that most of the people who do are the kind of rich type of people who aren't apt to get too enthused. But this year, because of the weather, for the first time ever, they played on the middle Sunday. And since there were no tickets printed for that day, they just let anybody who lined up, and many thousands of people slept overnight in the street to get in, anybody who lined up got into center court. So you had a completely different kind of crowd. You had kids and teenagers and people who were just thrilled to be inside the gates of Wimbledon, probably for the first and in many cases the only time of their life. And they just had a great time out there.
Well, I heard players saying that they loved it.
Oh, well, absolutely. Because it was different, and it was what they're not used to at Wimbledon. But I promise you, if it was every day for 13 days at Wimbledon, the players would say, gee, I wish the crowds would be a little bit less rowdy. You can be sure that whatever happens in tennis that affects the players, eventually they'll want it changed.
You say the U.S. Open is the tournament that everyone loves to hate. What makes it so awful?
Well, there are a number of things. The facilities, which are going to be redone and rebuilt in the next few years, are the least adequate of any of the Grand Slams. There aren't enough practice courts. The locker rooms are too small. Obviously, with New York traffic, just getting two in the courts can be a nightmare. In 1986, John McEnroe and Peter Fleming were defaulted from a doubles match because they got stuck in traffic on the Long Island Expressway. For a fan, it's a lot of fun because there's electricity everywhere. But for the players, it can be a nightmare because everything is hard. Everything is inconvenient. And when you're in the same place for 2 weeks trying to win a Grand Slam tournament, you want everything to be easy.
You also say that that the U.S. Open is run by CBS TV.
I don't think there's any question. The U.S. Tennis Association has really sold out its authority to run the tournament to CBS. Because CBS pays so much money, they are allowed to dictate the schedule. They tell the USTA who they want on the stadium court and when, who they want playing night matches. The U.S. Open is the only major tournament in the world that forces the players to play singles semifinals and the final on back-to-back days. Every other tournament has women's semis Thursday, men's semis Friday, women's final Saturday, men's final Sunday. So there's a rest day between the semis and final for everybody. Because CBS wants that so-called Super Saturday with the two men's semifinals and the women's final tucked in between, there's absolutely no semblance of rest or reality for the players. The women's final of the U.S. Open is the only major sporting event where the players wake up that morning not knowing what time the match is going to begin. Hmm. So how do they prepare? And they're playing a Grand Slam final. They could go on court at 2 in the afternoon or at 5 in the afternoon.
Are you a tennis player?
A bad one.
Well, I was wondering if you've covered all these players, whether you've ever played tennis with them.
No. You know, one of the things that you don't do when you cover professional athletes is try to inject your life into theirs. Because first of all, they're not interested. They really aren't. And I've always felt that my contact with them, the time I spend with them, is because they understand that I have a job to do. And for me to impose my brand of tennis on them would probably be like them imposing their brand of writing on me.
John Feinstein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
John Feinstein is a sports writer and commentator. His book about professional tennis is called Hard Courts. This is Fresh Air.